here are three things I think you should know about today. And this is really important. There is a historic shift that has just happened that will change our world as we know it. And that shift in large measure was on display at the White House just a couple of days ago. And I'm gonna tell you all about it. You know what else I'm gonna do? I'm gonna break down for you the actual statistical difference economically and militarily between the old powers of Europe and the new powers of the global South. That's the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm kind of thinking that something big, I've been thinking about this, it's been remunerating in my head for the last couple of months, you know, for the last couple of days, but it's something that's happened in the last month. So it's huge, it's global, and it's happening right before our eyes. I think this is historic because, you see, the world as we know it, I think, has just significantly changed. And here's what I'm trying to say that I think happened or was kind of catalyzed, right? Think about the history of the world for a moment, right? And you realize when we think back that there have always been huge powers and even empires, Mesopotamia, the Egyptians, and the Persians, and then Europe. And then, of course, the British Empire, and then the Spanish Empire, and the conquest of the Americas. And then, speaking of the Americas, finally, the U.S., with a total hegemony, essentially controlling the entire world with the help of a few old colonial powers in Europe, right? And that's been the way it's been since what? Right after World War II. The U.S. became the newest empire, and they've been that militarily and economically. And then suddenly, in the last couple of years, but especially in the last couple of weeks, and that's my point, this empire has not been able to strike back. We've seen it with the advent of BRICS nations, for sure, but it was especially on display with the threat of the tariffs that China scoffed at, as did Brazil, right? That was interesting. It was telling. Because what they were telling the empire was, sorry, the gig is up. You're no longer going to be able to tell us what to do. That's what those two countries did. And it was a big deal. But where the rubber really started to meet the road, in fact, where it may really have come to a screeching halt, was with India. You see, I think that was the true Waterloo moment. The final threat, if you will, that did not go well. And here's what it was. When Donald Trump tells India, you must not buy oil from Russia or I will punish you severely, the whole world kind of leaned in, right, to see and wait what was going to happen. How would they react? This is this cataclysmic moment. I mean, that's when it all happened. What global economists would call maybe the final dagger if India had the intestinal fortitude to do it, right? And what did India tell him? What did India tell Trump and the U.S.? Sorry, but you don't tell us what to do. That's what they said. In fact, right here, sitting in that chair on the Sanchez effect, the world heard India's response as clear as day when the Indian envoy explained to me how his country sees how they would describe what the U.S. tried to do.
U.S. decision is actually unjust, unfair, and unreasonable.
Unjust, unfair, and unreasonable. There you go. And we ain't gonna do it. That's what he was saying. Except being, you know, a man of prestige like him, he probably didn't say it. He said it isn't. His words were precise, though. They were cutting and they were telling. So much so that they may very well be the source of Donald Trump's newfound appreciation for the new world order he now seems to be espousing at the White House, with Europeans, no less. One where Donald Trump realizes, that the U.S. policy of always trying to dominate larger countries like Russia can turn out to be both counterproductive and unnecessary.
There's no threat from Russia. And that's essentially what President Trump demonstrated on Friday. Look at the way he behaved. Look at the feelings that were expressed publicly between President Trump and President Putin. There is no reason for hostility between the United States and the American people and Russia and the Russian people. None. That was made very clear. To put it in the parlance of people down south, we don't have a dog in the fight, okay?
Yeah, we don't. We don't. That's Colonel Doug McGregor. He's a longtime unofficial advisor to President Trump. I mean, I know they talk a lot. He's also a friend of this show. And here's the advice to Trump going into the meeting, with the European officials and with Zelensky.
President Trump is going to sit there. He's going to be polite because he is, by nature, very polite. And he's going to listen to them. He's going to say, look, it's over. We refuse to go any further. We are prepared for a solution. And we discussed that solution with President Putin, and we think that solution under the circumstances is legitimate. We will not support Ukraine inside NATO. We will support a neutral Ukrainian rump state. Now, here's the kicker. If you, ladies and gentlemen from Europe, are determined to press ahead, that is your privilege.
So that's the advice the colonel gave the Trump, Mr. Trump. And lo and behold, I don't know if you watched, but that seemed to be pretty much what the president did. He played it loose. He played it cool. He was polite while he emasculated both Zelensky and his European supporters. Here, watch. We got a clip.
I want to thank you also that you mentioned the thousands of Ukrainian children that have been abducted. And as a mother and grandmother, every single child has to go back to its family.
I was just thinking we're here for a different reason.
To be honest, we all would like to see a ceasefire.
In the six wars that I've settled, I haven't had a ceasefire. I don't think there's any issue that's overly complex. It's at a point now where people want to do things. I really do believe. I've known him for a long time. I've always had a great relationship with him. I think that President Putin wants to find an answer, too.
I like Putin. Sorry, I have a relationship with him. And by the way, you guys can think and do what you want to do, but this is the way we're going to move forward. That pretty much was what he was establishing, right? I mean, by all indications, it seems that at the end of the day, the deal that Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin have come to and put on the table has been begrudgingly accepted by Zelensky and this group of seven. The ceasefire is not going to happen. It's just not. The four Russian-speaking oblasts, they're going to be ceded one way or another to Russia. The only potential pitfall could be the demand of peacekeepers in Ukraine, which still seems to be some kind of sticking point, something Russia's chief diplomat has flat out said, this is Mr. Lavrov talking, that, you know, he's not comfortable with that because of Russian security concerns.
We cannot agree that collective security issues are proposed to be resolved without the Russian Federation. This is impossible. We have repeatedly explained that Russia does not exaggerate its interests, but we will defend our legitimate interests firmly and persistently. I'm sure that the West, especially the United States, understands that seriously discussing security without Russia's participation is a utopia and a road to nowhere.
Here's kind of where we are. If this deal is finally consummated, the message that it's going to send globally will be truly historic. It will mean the beginning of the end for unipolarity, right? The end of the era of Germany and the UK and French and the Americans always telling everybody else what to do. It will become part of the past. Why? Because they really are dwarfed by larger countries with bigger and more powerful economies. That's just a fact, Jack. Countries like China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Russia. Listen to how my friend and a guy that I think is one of the smartest global economies in the world explains just the issue of how GDP has moved.
The GDP of the United States and its major ally, known as the G7, seven countries, and they have together about 28% of the global GDP, the total output of goods and services of all countries on this planet. Now, for most of the last 75 years, this was the center of the global economy. The G7 accounted for a wildly disproportionate amount, and they still do, although not what they once did. If the G7 is 28% of global GDP, what is China and the BRICS? Answer, 35% of global GDP.
28 to 35%. Things have changed. And guess what? It gets worse. See, when you look beyond total GDP and you look at things like GDP growth, which some say is more important, the size of the standing armies of these countries, the size of the population of these countries. It is not even close. The BRICS nations make up 60% of the world's population, 60%. And when it comes to GDP growth, the shift is staggering. I looked it up and I put it together for you, so I want to show it to you. Look at this. According to measures from the World Bank, the U.S.'s GDP growth is 2.8%. France is 1.2%. The U.K. is 1.1%. Germany is growing at a lowly negative rate of negative 0.2%. Can you believe that? Now let's look at the total economic growth for the four aforementioned BRICS countries. Look at the difference. Brazil is growing at 3.4%. Russia at 4.3%, China 5%, India 6.5%. You see the difference? I mean, it's not even close. The paradigm is shifting. And we can say the same thing militarily as well. Let's look at standing armies in the world, for example. According to the World Population Review, the U.S. has 1.3 million total personnel. France has 475,000. The UK has 215,000, Germany 200,000. Just the three top countries in BRICS alone top those numbers by a wide margin. Russia has a total fighting force of 1.1 million. India comes in at 1.5. China tops everybody with a fighting force of 2.1 million. That's more than double compared to the top four G7 countries. So you see where we are. You know what it makes me think of? Remember when we were kids? I don't know, maybe you read it or not. Remember the story of the emperor's new clothes that we all remember reading back when we were in grade school? Everybody thought the emperor was so great and so powerful until one moment changed everything for Mr. Emperor, right? I'm kind of thinking the same thing just happened a couple days ago. The White House, when in one moment, just like that, the world realized, thanks in part to none other than Donald Trump, Europe's so-called elites, right? They no longer look so great. And they certainly did not look powerful. So you've probably heard as well, and will no doubt be hearing much more about something I'm about to show you. This is a map, okay? Here it is. This is the map that Mr. Trump displayed for Mr. Zelensky and all the world to see at the White House. He just popped it on him right there. Zelensky didn't know this was coming. It is essentially a map with the new borders of Ukraine, with the Russian-speaking provinces, or oblasts, as they're called there, Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, and, of course, Crimea. They're now officially part of Russia. That's the plan. I wanted to know, though, and always have, what are these places? What are these four oblasts that we hear about so much and used to be part of Ukraine? Are they simply conquered Ukrainian territories that the Russians have invaded, as they're described by some media in the West? What do the people there want? Seriously, what do the people want? Are they Russians? Are they Ukrainians? Are they both? And what's the history of these places that most of you have never even heard of or could find on a map? Well, suddenly those places are about to become very important for the whole world. So to answer those questions, we called on the governor of one of those oblasts. I called on the governor of Kherson. His name is Vladimir Saldo. He's a man with a smile as big as life. Really nice guy. And what's interesting about him is he has spent his entire life in Kherson. His parents are from Kherson. His grandparents are Kherson. He was a citizen in Kherson. He was the mayor of Kherson. And now I introduce you to the governor of Kherson. Joining us now is Vladimir Saldo. He is the governor of Kherson, and he is good enough to share with us now some of the information about what's going on in his particular region. Mr. Governor, thank you so much, sir, for joining us.
Hello.
So let's start with Mr. Putin is essentially saying to Mr. Trump, saying to the world, look, here's what we want. We want the military of Ukraine to get out of those four oblasts, including Kherson. And we also want a guarantee of security. So that's what Mr. Putin is asking for, essentially. What do your people want? What do the people of Kherson want?
People in the Kherson region, as well as everywhere in the world, of course, want to have a clear sky above their heads so that shells don't explode, so that drones don't fly, so that artillery doesn't work, and so that they can live in peace on the land that historically belongs to them, so that they can work in peace, so that they can think about tomorrow, so that they can raise their children and know where they will work or study and how they will live. The same thing is wanted by people living in the Kherson region. And in general, they have the right to that, the same as everyone else. Only starting around 2014 or even a little earlier, our people or those who live near the Black Sea and the Azov Sea, the Kherson region has access to two seas. It is washed by two seas, the Azov and the Black, and has a large length of the Dnieper waterways. And so, since about 2014 or even a little earlier, they started being occupied. They began to tell them that you are not Russian, that you don't live here. You live on foreign land, not your own land. And as a result, now Russia has done everything to ensure that people have the opportunity to live where they want and to speak any way they want.
So that's interesting. Those people starting in 2014, starting to be, what, abused, maltreated by the government of Ukraine? Is that what you're saying? How so? How were they maltreated?
Yes, you've quite correctly interpreted what it is I want to say. It was precisely from 2014 that they began to vigorously impose their ideas that they could not speak their native language, that they needed to speak more and more in Ukrainian, one of the languages native to them. And for some reason, people were forbidden from speaking Russian. They started telling them that historically the Kherson region, and not only the Kherson region, but the whole southern part, which was in Ukraine, that it is not and has never been Russian. It's a completely different land. In actual fact, people who know their ancestors, they know the history of their native land. They understand perfectly that they live on the land that in the 18th century was an absolute desert with only nomads roaming here and there. And those that did live there were taken into slavery. There were no cities, nothing. At the Black Sea and at the Azov Sea, those steppes were completely empty. There was nothing in the steppe. And that was exactly when Russia got the opportunity to access the Black and Azov Seas and began to build cities and populate these lands. Therefore, they know all this, but since 2014, they've had certain ideas purposefully hammered into them. But I can say this, when the so-called Revolution of Dignity took place in 2014, it turns out that this dignity was realized with the help of burning tires, including right near my house and through the rejection of values. That is, they began to do everything in order to force people not to think freely, but rather to think exactly as they wanted them to. And they did it, we understand that, perfectly well. This is why people, after all, have had their consciousness suppressed since 2014. They were not allowed to think freely. They were disconnected from free sources of information. They were told that they could only watch Ukrainian television. They were disconnected from the social networks of their friends. This happened in the last years until 2022, when Russia came to their aid.
What about the church? Were they told where they had to worship as well?
Yes, people were even being told who to pray to. They started being told that the Orthodox Church, which was everywhere in cities and villages, is divided and not even what they are used to. Although, to be honest, people knew that there is one Christ, one Jesus. But for some reason, they said that the dioceses were different. And when the dioceses were divided, it meant that priests were forbidden from speaking Russian, and even services were forbidden. They were told that these churches belonged to Moscow, and those churches were of the Kyiv region. Although Kyiv and Moscow are essentially cities that were capitals and were always children of one God, Christ.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. This is maybe the most important question I can ask you. If tomorrow I, Rick Sanchez, and I'm sure I will want to go one day to Kherson, where you and I can have some wonderful borscht. If I went to your oblast and I interviewed all the people there and I asked them, do you want to be Russian? Do you want to be a part officially of Russia, I should say? Would the vast majority of them say yes, da?
I'll tell you this, the overwhelming majority will answer yes in their minds, but there is one thing. Over all these years, people have been taught to be so afraid that they are not always sincere, and even when sociological surveys are conducted, it is difficult to get a real picture or more accurate answers, more sincere answers. They may tell you one thing over the phone, but looking in your eyes, they will say, of course, bravely, but not quite accurately. They can deceive. And so, for all these years, they need to be understood. They've been conditioned, taught to be insincere.
What do you think that your people generally want to be a part of Russia, a part of this thing that Mr. Putin is asking for? And if that's the case, what percentage would you say? 90%?
Well, first of all, we saw the percentage when the referendum was held. The referendum did take place, and somewhere around 80 to 85% of people expressed their opinion on where they wished to be. That is, they were not pulled from here and here. They lived in the Soviet Union, and they knew that it was a big country in which many of them were born, grew up, studied. So there was nothing new. It's simply a historical justice that was restored. And our president also essentially said, even in Alaska, he said this after completing negotiations with the US president, the Russian and Ukrainian people essentially are one people. And even by nationality, a lot of Russians live there, in the Kherson region, precisely by nationality. Principally, we're all the same.
Yes, I know. It's a history. You're absolutely right. And most people understand that now, that the Russian people and the Ukrainian people are essentially one people. They're brothers. They're brothers and sisters. It's not like the United States when they went to Ukraine and they saw those people as enemy, or what's happening now with Israel and the Palestinians, where the Palestinians are seen as enemies and the Palestinians see Israel as enemy. It's a very different situation, and I'm glad you pointed that out. Let me ask you this, though, because a lot of people are watching this all over the world. Millions of people are going to watch this interview, and they don't know what Kherson is like, so they're wondering, so you are the mayor and now the governor. What happens to that other 15%? What happens to those 15% of people who live in Kherson, who still like and respect Ukraine and feel Ukrainian? How are you going to deal with them?
We have already started a general conversation about what people want. It's such a complex situation. What do people want? I've already said this, but I can say it again. They'll be fine. They'll be much better off than the situation they're in now. We're talking about those who are still on the right bank, on the right part of the Kherson region. We're talking about them. I'll tell you what's going on, those who are still there. They're still those people, their minds are occupied. They're not given the opportunity to get reliable information. They live in fear, for sure, because we have a connection with people. Take, for example, the Berlin Wall was built after the World War II. Now, the Dnieper resembles the Berlin Wall. That is, we have the same people, but on different sides, only this time it is a wall of water. Or as in Korea, yes, South and North Korea, that is. They've been divided artificially, and it was divided, of course, not by the people. The people would have sorted it out amongst themselves, but the rulers, those who tell you who should do what, divide us. They continue to try to make sure that even information doesn't get through. I'll tell you another thing. Those same authorities or representatives of the Kiev regime who work on Kherson in the city itself, what are they doing now? They are continuing to scare them and tell the people, you know, Russia will come. They'll come back here anyway. It will not consider you all as people. It will not recognize you as citizens of Russia because you were under, allegedly under the occupation of Ukraine, and therefore leave here. That is, they encourage them to leave there.
Have you seen any signs of that up to now? I mean, during this war, what was the behavior of the Russian army in Kherson? Were your people mistreated by the Russian army?
Let's put it this way. How did the servicemen of the Russian army behave? Probably that would be a more pertinent question. In relation to the residents, in relation to the territory they came to, they behaved absolutely normally. That is, not as conquerors, but more as liberators. And for the most part, you know, as we used to say, the people and the army are one. Not right away, of course, people recognized the military as their own because we lived and lived and lived and there was no military there. There were no people with weapons on the streets. There was no military equipment. And then suddenly all this equipment appeared. Soldiers appeared. A large number of outsiders appeared. So the people of Kherson, of course, were wary of this at first. As in any other country, people with weapons are treated with caution. They want to cross, they see the armed soldiers, they cross to the other side of the street or go around them. But that was only in the beginning. Then when they saw a loyal, calm attitude, that is, if you even go to the checkpoints or somewhere where there are military personnel, you can always see civilians nearby. Guys with girls, with civilians, some back and forth is taking place. In general, these are their own people. They are not strangers. They speak the same language. They try everything to help or to explain things. There are some moments when there are a lot of people. Something happens, maybe something unusual, but these are isolated incidents. Basically, the military in the Kherson region are perceived as liberators and they help people. That is, they help with humanitarian aid. What's happening now? The Kiev regime is still trying to create tension on the left bank, shelling populated areas, shelling fields, setting fire to them, setting forests on fire, like when, excuse me, they burned jungles in Vietnam with napalm. All this now happening in the Kherson region, and who is the first to come to the rescue? Of course, it's the military. They are there, those who are in the area. Of course, a unit from the Ministry of Emergency Situations. And who helped out when there was a catastrophe, when the Kharkova Dam was blown up and the water flooded the fields and the homes of the people who lived there? Of course the military helped, so the mutual understanding between the military and the citizens is absolutely normal, complete. If there are no deviations, there are no such cases. If there are any cases, it's usually among the military themselves.
No, and that jives with what I've read and what I've seen and some of the other reports that I've seen that have come out of the region. I've also read that there have been assassination attempts on your life, that they have tried to kill you. I'm not sure who or how, but it makes me wonder if that's the case, sir. What's going on in your heart? How angry are you? Do you hate Ukrainians for that? And Will you ever be able to move beyond that so that maybe at some point, some in the future, Ukraine and Russia can be brothers again and respect the border?
Yes, I'll start a bit from your last question. I remember very well the times when it was a big country and when it was the Soviet Union. It had many republics, 15. There were many nationalities, very different, Muslims and different religions, many Orthodox people of all kinds. The part where we lived, the southern part of the Soviet Union, it had even a more multinational population. And so everyone had such a mixed culture, and we competed in sports, competed in some cultural traditions, in anything, but we certainly didn't fight with each other. And now this artificial civil confrontation that has been created or is being created, I emphasize, has been done artificially. So I will tell you this. The best borders between Ukraine and Russia when there were republics was imagined as a very large table at which people sit and eat, dine together. Russia across from Ukraine. This is the key to how I see it. Why should I be offended by Ukrainians or the people who live there? I don't hold any grudges against them at all.
Because they tried to kill you.
But they tried to kill me. Excuse me, not ordinary people, not ordinary people who walk the streets. I'll tell you even more. Do you know why they didn't kill me after all? There were several cases in Kherson when they planted homemade explosive devices along the route that I often traveled along. Because in Kherson, I was the mayor for 11 years. Everyone knew me. Any person knew. But they didn't kill me because those same people warned me. They said, don't go down that street. There's something lying in the bushes. They were the ones who saved me. It was completely different people who tried to kill me. They tried to kill me on the orders of Kiev. Back when they decided that it was necessary to remove the leaders of public opinion, back when that was already the war for which the Kyiv regime was prepared. And they trained them on who needs to be removed immediately. Of course, the leaders need to be removed immediately. That's why they tried to do it. But people saved me, of course, only when there was an incident from which I had a hard time getting out. It was poisoning. I was poisoned. They poisoned me specifically with a toxic combat substance, and it took me about a month and a half to recover. That happened too, but probably the Almighty thinks that there is no need to take me quite yet. I'm still here, which means that people need me, so that's it. I think differently. I dream of a time when I can talk to my fellow countrymen no longer through TV screens or through phones or gadgets, but just go outside and talk calmly. I always walked outside. And even if I was criticized, I still talk to people. I just love people. I think that, well, the function of people like me is to help people inspire, lead, and create a better life.
It seems that way. Just from the short time that you and I have gotten to know each other here, I can tell that you have that way about you. You're a communicative person. You're a friendly person, and I think that's an important asset to help people get through what they're going through now. Hey, let me ask you about something the European leaders are saying. I've heard Macron and Starmer and Merz and some of these leaders say that they want to put peacekeepers on the ground. They want to put French soldiers or maybe German soldiers or maybe, I don't know, British, UK soldiers or maybe American soldiers on the ground there to keep the peace. What would your reaction be to that?
What is the function of the so-called peacekeepers? Are we attacking each other now or what? If a peace agreement is reached, why do we need peacekeepers? We all live together and we will find a common language among ourselves faster. Let's look at global examples where there was peacekeepers and where it really brought peace, where there are military actions, where there are, for example, confrontations in Kosovo or in Africa. In some countries there, probably such help is needed. In Ukraine and Russia, we don't need that kind of help. We just talked about how people perceive military personnel. I already said this. They will fully protect them from any moments related to civil, perhaps confrontations with attempts to destabilize society. Russians are very peace-loving, you know? On the contrary, they are ready to help. They will not attack anyone. This is all a made-up horror story, you know, which is akin to what you see in various films, you know? Soon someone will fly in from space, attack the planet. Now the Russians will attack someone.
Let me ask you this question for clarity, because I think there's probably a lot of people out here who are still watching us, and they're thinking, oh, so this man, this governor, right, Mr. Saldo, is a Russian, and he lived in Moscow, and he was sent to Kherson to now rule over these people. I just want people to understand that's not the case. You're from Kherson. You are a citizen of Kherson. You've lived in Kherson, and you've been there for many, many years, I imagine, if not decades, right? Is that true?
I was born in Nikolaev, near Kherson, 60 kilometers away. I studied in the city of Kryvyi Rog, 240 kilometers from Kherson. In general, I grew up, studied, and prospered on this land. No one sent me anywhere. I wasn't sent from Moscow. I wasn't sent from Kyiv to be mayor either. I was elected by the people, and people, you know, people treat their leaders like they scold them, yes, but they appreciate them too and treat them with respect. This is my land. This is my homeland, and I treat it just like probably every person on the planet. Of course, there are people who like to travel, people of the world. I don't consider myself as such. I was a deputy of the Ukrainian parliament. I was elected, but I always returned to Kherson on the weekends. Yes, I came to Moscow on a business trip, but I don't live in Moscow.
But that's so important because people, you know, if you hear the Western media, they'll say that Russia has invaded and taken over this place where it doesn't belong. Actually, the place is Russian. You're Russian. You were Russian when you were the mayor before, and you're still Russian now, or I imagine you feel Russian, right? Do you consider yourself, when you look in the mirror, do you see a Russian?
I see a person who loves his native land. It is called Russia. It is part of Russia, part of a big, big country. I'll tell you more when, in 2022, I had my first meeting with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin. We discussed personnel policy and who to appoint or who to represent in the elections to the Senate, in the elections to local authorities. We seem to have a shortage of specialists, you know, there is a personnel shortage everywhere. He told me, raise your own people, raise the locals. This is their land. Even if they don't know how and don't know something now, they can learn. But first of all, we need to raise our own. This was told to me by the president of Russia, who, of course, could have given the order and they would have come. They do come. They come to help. Some like it and stay. They recognize this land and they like to live here. Anyone who has visited the Kherson region can't help but love it because it is a blessed place. With breathtaking nature, we have everything we need to live comfortably and work with interest and develop.
It sounds like what he was telling you is what seems to be happening there. Kherson should be for the people of Kherson, and Kherson should remain for the people of Kherson, not for someone from the outside. That doesn't mean others can't come in and be a part of it, but it is, it has been, and it will remain Kherson as it was when it was part of the Soviet Union, as it was when it was part of Ukraine, and as it will be now moving forward if this works out as a part of Russia. Did I get that right?
You know, Kherson, of course, the city of Kherson itself on the right bank, it is the regional center. Now, there are very few residents left. Some left or were forced to leave to different parts of the Russian Federation. Someone lives on the left bank now temporarily. Someone went the other way to the west. But the city, it is like a person, you know what I mean? It's like a house in which this person lived. It is waiting for its residents and they'll return to it. They want to return to it, and it is waiting for them. And so I therefore think that cities have a soul. They are created by human hands. There was nothing here before. It was an empty space. It was a place that was chosen by Prince Potemkin. And a completely new city was built here. It didn't exist at all. Well, you know, the soul of the people who lived there, who died here, who will live here. Therefore, I believe this is my opinion, but I think it coincides with the opinion of many that you cannot separate people artificially like this. We need to overcome this line that was invented. We need to overcome this line that the leaders who are so famous today are trying to create, those who are trying to lead Zelensky by the hand, who has been to Kherson many times before, when he was still an actor and who was born nearby in the city of Kryvyi Rog, not far from Kherson. There's no need for all this opposition. All the same, it will not lead to anything good, and no, certainly not to happiness for the residents of Kherson region, and even more so geopolitically. It won't give opportunities for the leaders of European states. Why do they need this? Let them explain it. They can't really explain anything. They deceive their people by telling them fairy tales about Russia, and they deceive themselves.
It may be that power and money makes people do strange things, Mr. Governor. Well, Mr. Putin said to Mr. Trump at the end of their discussion next time in Moscow. So I will say to you as we finish this conversation between you and I, hopefully, right, next time in Kherson.
See you there. I will show you around Kherson.
Thank you so much. And that's our show. Thank you so much for being with us. This is The Sanchez Effect, and I'll be looking for you right here next time.